in detail because it is such an important part of the path. And so this, now we're going back to page 22. At the bottom of the page, after the suttas on parents, we have a sutta called Archery, Sanyutta Nikaya 3:24, page 22 at the bottom. A very short extract from a much longer sutta, but just to focus on the one thing that is that this is about, the idea of generosity, essentially. So this is how this sutta goes. This is just a tiny part of it, as I said. At Savati, sitting to one side, King Pasenadi of Kosala said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, where should a gift be given?" And the Buddha replies, "Where one's mind has confidence, great King." Right? And this is one of those interesting little quotes, because very often when you hear Buddhists talking about giving, they will say, "Oh, you have to give it to the arahants, right? Or to the Aryas, to the noble ones." Or they might say, perhaps you have to give to the Sangha and these kind of things. But that's what most people say, but the Buddha doesn't say that. When the Buddha is the only place in the sutta where he is asked this question, where should a gift be given? And what he says is, where your mind has confidence. Pasidati is the Pali word. It means like where your mind feels peaceful, calm, tranquil. That is where you should actually give a gift. And this is interesting, right? Because what it means is that we don't kind of prioritize Buddhism not too much. We also understand that the idea of giving is something that is very broad. We should include everybody in this. Nobody should really be left outside. So it means that every time we have an opportunity to give, every time we see somebody in need, a worthy cause, we are willing to support people in need in a difficult cause. Whenever your heart kind of opens up, you feel compassion, you feel that this would be a good thing to do, right? You see some worthy cause. Whenever you feel the sense of, yeah, this would be nice, your mind feels confident and good about it, then it is always a good time to give. Sometimes spontaneously you feel, whoa, I want to give. And give quickly before your rational mind says, no, that's dangerous. Right? Because this is how often the mind goes. The mind is often very, very tricky in that particular way. And what is important about this, I think, is that even if something may not be the highest merit as such, what we are doing by learning to give when you feel confident about something, when you feel kind of tranquil and happy about it, you are actually learning the power of generosity. You're using every opportunity and you're learning from that. If you wait till the perfect moment, till you find just the right arahant, right, that kind of stuff, you may never end up giving very much, because there's very few and far between these days the arahants in the world. So you end up kind of just sitting there on your whatever you have and never being able to share with anyone. So you're learning to give, right? And this is the wonderful thing about this. You're learning the power of generosity by doing it. And this is one of those very important things. And of course, one of the things that you find is that generosity, the idea, we were talking about this at lunch yesterday as well, one of the ideas of generosity is to feel a sense of uplift while you do it. If you feel joy while you're giving, that is the ideal way of giving. And the reason why it is so ideal is because if you feel joyful, it tends to come together with mindfulness, it comes together with energy, and it tends to leave a very powerful imprint on your mind. And if it leaves a powerful imprint on your mind, it means that later on it's easy to recall, right? Because it kind of sits deep inside in a sense. Then when you sit down, you close your eyes, it kind of flushes, comes back to you again, and you can't really avoid remembering those powerful imprints on your mind. It becomes like a small trauma in your life, right? And that trauma kind of comes back to you on all kinds of occasions. So, and this reminds me also of another sutta. This is a sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya which talks about the again, the power of I think the power of kindness in general, the power of generosity, the power of morality, and all these kind of things, and why it is so important. And what the Buddha says here, he uses a simile of a person who works all day, right? They work really hard, and when they come home at night, they kind of sit down, and then they feel, because they have been living well, doing the right thing, living morally upright, being kind to other people, then when they sit down, it's like all of these acts, they come back to them, and they feel automatically happy when they kind of rest in the evening, when they kind of come back and they lie down, or whatever it is. And the simile, the Buddha says, just like a mountain. When you have a big mountain and you have the house on the slope of the mountain, and then in the evening the sun goes down behind the mountain, then the shadow of that mountain will envelop that house completely. It will be completely enveloped in that shadow because it is on the kind of the eastern side of the mountain. The sun goes down in the west, right? And you have this complete enveloping, and there's no part of that house which is not inside the shadow of that mountain. In the same way, if you do a mountain of good actions, this is what this is about, a mountain of good actions, and not a mountain of bad actions, right? But very, very few bad, a molehill of bad actions and a mountain of good actions. Then those good actions, they will envelop you, they will kind of embed you almost, right, in the at any time of the day, but especially when you settle down to rest, when you meditate, when you come back home in the evening after work, whatever it is, you will feel the feeling of your kindness. This is the ideal way of practicing morality and generosity. And this is why it is so important to feel that sense of joy even while you do the giving, even while you do acts of kindness in the world. The mountain of good acts comes back and it kind of completely envelops you in that, and you feel good as a consequence. It's a very nice image. It's hard to do. Maybe not hard. It takes a lot of commitment to be able to do that, but the benefits are obviously enormous if you're able to live in this way here. So that is the Buddha talking to King Pasenadi about how to give. In the next sentence, I haven't actually included that here, King Pasenadi asked, where is the most merit? Where is the best merit? And the Buddha said, the best merit is when you give to the, I think he says, arahants or something like that. That's the kind of highest individual merit, right? Arahants or the Buddha or whatever. Or the, I can't remember exactly what he says. But before you get to that most merit, you have to learn to give in the right way. And that's why you always take the opportunity when the opportunity arises. Okay. Next sutta on generosity. This is called Vatsa. This is a famous ascetic at the time of the Buddha called Vatsagotta. And he has a lot of conversations with the Buddha. In the suttas, you see him conversing with the Buddha all the time. I can imagine, I'm not sure if the Buddha got a bit fed up with this this ascetic after a while, because he always comes and asks him questions. The Buddha, of course, has endless patience. There should not be no problem there. This is from the Anguttara 3, and Vatsagotta has asked him a question, and this is what the Buddha replies. Those Vatsa who say, the ascetic Gotama says, alms should be given only to me, not to others. Alms should be given only to my disciples, not to the disciples of others. Only what is given to me is very fruitful, not what is given to others. Only what is given to my disciples is very fruitful, not what is given to the disciples of others. Those people who say that do not state what has been said by me, but represent me with what is untrue and contrary to fact. One who prevents another from giving alms creates an obstruction and stumbling block for three people. What three? He creates an obstruction to the donor acquiring merit. He creates an obstruction to the recipient gaining a gift, and he already has maimed and injured himself. One who prevents another from giving alms creates an obstruction and stumbling block for these three people. Right? So we should always encourage generosity. It doesn't matter to who it is. It doesn't matter if it is to an animal. It doesn't matter, certainly if it is a human being. It's always good to be generous. Even if it is a human being who doesn't have the greatest morality, still generosity is very, very useful in all of those cases. We should always report that. Always be positive about that. It always has a positive result. So keep that in mind. This is again this idea of taking every opportunity, right? And we will see more about this just now in the next paragraph, about this idea of taking every opportunity here. But Vatsa, I say that one acquires merit even if one throws away the dishwashing water in a refuse dump or cesspit with the thought, may the living beings here sustain themselves with this. How much more then does one acquire merit when one gives to human beings? However, I say that what is given to one of virtuous behavior is more fruitful than what is given to an immoral person. And the most worthy recipient is the one who has abandoned five factors and possesses five factors. So here, and the Buddha is saying that even if you throw away your dishwashing water, right? You throw it out on the grass or throw it out on a refuse heap, and there may be a few grains of rice in that dishwashing water, a little bit of leftover food from the meal. If you throw it out with the thought, with the intention, may the little insects, the little ants, the little whatever it is, may they enjoy that, then you are already making merit. Right, it's so easy to make merit when you start to think about it. There are so many opportunities, right? And the difference between making merit and not making merit, very often it is just one of intention. You can throw, most people just throw away the dishwashing water without thinking about it, or just throw it out, you want to get rid of it. The only difference between that person and the one who makes merit thinks, honestly, in their heart, may the little beings out there, may they actually live on this, may they enjoy this, and you throw it out for the benefit of those living beings. Yeah? So that was just to kind of make the point extra powerfully. So it's often, it is just a matter of the mind state, right? Whether you make good karma or not. It's just a matter of thinking in the right way. And when you think in the right way, there are so many opportunities in life to do what is good, to do what is kind, to be generous, and to support other people. And one of the ways that I like often to say is that when you do anything in life, for example, when you go to work, right, then there's different attitudes you can have when you go to work. Either you can just do your job because you have to work, you have to make money, you want to make progress, you want to make a career, and that sort of thing. And all of that is kind of slightly greedy. It's about me, it's about my job, and about what I get out of it. But one way of making good karma, even when you're working, is to remember the people who are beneficiaries of what you do, right? There are customers, there are co-workers who work in a company. There are always people who are beneficiaries of the work that you do. And when you think about that, instead of thinking about just about yourself, you can actually make good karma and make money at the same time. Right? Win-win situation. Money and good karma. Yay! Right? This is a way, simple way of kind of making good karma in everyday life. We make the ordinary things, we make them special, we lift them up to a new level. And then when you start to think like that, you start to look for other opportunities. How can I be kind to my co-workers rather than always, you know, I don't know what it's like to have, my co-workers are really good actually, very easy to be kind to them, but co-workers probably vary, but you think more about how you can be kind to them, support them, what can you do for them in the right way, and then you are on the right track, right? Taking every opportunity. So this is, I think, one of the most important messages of this sutta, is that there are so many opportunities to do what is good. It's just about our mind state, putting our minds to it, thinking about things in the right way, taking every opportunity, and then it is you can make your whole life into a blessing, right? Into something positive. This is what I try to do when I sit here. And I try to think, okay, how can I make this nice for the people who listen? How can I kind of give them something extra, right? How can I do it whenever I teach somewhere? How can I kind of make it a more kind of a gift in a sense from me here? Right, I don't think about, for example, oh, I hope they are really generous so that I can take back some money to the monastery afterwards, and then Ajahn Brahm will be really happy with me because then we can build another kuti or something. I don't think like that, right? What I think is, what can I do to be kind of, to give something extra and to be generous? And then it makes me happy when I can do some teaching as well. And then it becomes part of my practice, part of what I do as well. This is how I try to live. Not always perfectly well, but I try at the very least to live in that way here. Okay, so let us have a look at the next one here. This is from the Itivutaka, one of those books in the Kudaka Nikaya, not one of the four main Nikayas, but in the fifth one here. And this is a small little sutta which also talks about similar kind of thing here. O monks, if people knew as I know the result of giving and sharing, they would not eat a single meal without having given, nor would they allow the stain of miserliness, of niggardliness, to obsess them and take root in their minds. Even if it were their last morsel, their last mouthful, they would not eat without having shared it, if there were someone to share it with. But monks, as people do not know, as I know, the result of giving and sharing, they eat without having given, and the stain of miserliness obsesses them and takes root in their minds. Right, another one of these beautiful things about taking every opportunity, every chance to share and to be generous. And you wouldn't eat a single meal, says the Buddha here, without giving, if you really understood the power of generosity and what effect it has in your life, and also the effect it has in inspiring the people around you. Okay, let's go on to the next sutta. There's more about generosity here, and these are from Anguttara 461, worthy deeds. There are these four things that lead to the obtaining, the four things that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and rarely gained in the world. With wealth acquired by energetic striving, amassed by the strength of his arms, earned by the sweat of his brow, I think I mentioned this before, righteous wealth righteously gained, the noble disciple undertakes four worthy deeds. Right? And these four worthy deeds are how to basically be generous. We'll have a look at that in a second. But one of the important points here, again, as I was saying before, this idea that when we have wealth, it should be wealth that has been gained in the right way, right? Righteously, morally, in other words, ethically, not by kind of stealing or by cheating somebody, but you have really worked for that. And then you feel that you are the worthy recipient of that money. It really is yours. And that is when it is especially powerful and beautiful to share it with others, because it is a real act of generosity, real act of renunciation when you give up what is actually yours. So, what are these four worthy deeds? Here, householder, with wealth acquired by energetic striving, amassed by the strength of his arms, etc., righteously gained, the noble disciple makes himself happy and pleased and properly maintains himself in happiness. He makes his parents happy and pleased and properly maintain them in happiness. He makes his wife and children, maybe husband and children as well, his slaves, workers and servants happy and pleased, and properly maintain them in happiness. He makes his friends and companions happy and pleased, and properly maintains them in happiness. This is the first case of wealth that has gone to good use, that has been properly utilized and used for a worthy cause. Right? And this is quite interesting because it starts off with actually making yourself happy, right? Looking after yourself. And this is often against how people think about how to be generous. But we need to be generous towards ourselves as well and look after ourselves. And one of the reasons for that is because nobody in the world is closer to us than we are to ourselves. There's one person you know with absolute certainty that you can make happy because you know yourself better than anyone, and that is yourself. So make sure you also look after yourself. You have a sense of self-compassion, a sense of self-worth, that you are worthy of being given happiness in this way. It's a positive sense of feeling about oneself. Very interesting, because we ourselves cannot come on top of the hierarchy. Of course, the reality is that if you really know how to look after yourself, you understand that looking after yourself is not very different from looking after other people. Because when you look after others, then you look after yourself, because it makes you happy to look after others. When you look after yourself, it gives you more energy and to help to look after others as well. The two things are really just two sides of the same coin. And this is a kind of one of the beautiful things about the spiritual path. Understanding the spiritual path properly, any act that is spiritual is an act that benefits both yourself and benefits other people. But that is really what I would call a spiritual act or a spiritual thought. Both benefits you and it benefits others. We're talking about generosity here. Generosity benefits others, but also benefits you. Kindness benefits others, but also you. This is one of the definitions, I think, of what a spiritual action actually is all about. And then, of course, we just had a look at parents before, how important parents are, and that's why parents are next on the list, right? And then come your wife and children, or your husband and children, usually the suit as are spoken from the male point of view, but of course we can just substitute and see it from the female point of view as well. Then all the other people that are reliant on you, all the workers, all the servants, and even the slaves from those days, you look after them, then your friends and companions. So everybody who has some relationship to you, right, should look after in this way. This is the first way to use your wealth that has been amassed in the right way here. The first properly utilized, worthy cause of wealth. Then we have the second way. Again, with wealth acquired by energetic striving, etc., righteously gained, the noble disciple makes provisions against the losses that might arise from fire, floods, kings, thieves, and displeasing heirs. He makes himself secure against them. This is the second case of wealth gone to good use. Right, so you put a little bit of money aside for making sure you have a good lock on your door, that kind of stuff, you know, so that kind of the thieves don't come, the kings and the thieves don't come, it says here. Interesting how the kings and the thieves are kind of said in the same sentence in that way. Taxes, exactly, kings, taxes and thieves, they are kind of... I think taxes, of course, are important, right? Otherwise, society collapses if we don't have taxes. But sometimes kings might have gotten a bit greedy sometimes in the old days. Maybe that's why they are kind of singled out in this way. But if it is a righteous king and a righteous government who take what is needed to keep society going, then I think both kings and taxes are necessary for the survival of society here. So, again, so that is also wealth well used, right? Which is interesting. So that is kind of more a pragmatic way of using your wealth. And then we have the third one. Again, with wealth acquired by energetic striving, righteously gained, the noble disciple makes five kind of oblations. These are like offerings, oblations to relatives, to guests, to ancestors, to the king. Right now the king is in the good books, before he was in the bad books. And to the deities is the last one there. Again, this is the third case of wealth gone to good use. So interesting here that now we are kind of, deities is interesting as well as one of them. But kind of, this is a kind of an unusual list, right? It's not the kind of normal Buddhist ideas, perhaps, in some of these things. Relatives and guests, fair enough. Ancestors, sometimes we do acts of kindness in the name of people who passed away. That is what the ancestors is about here, really. The king, right? You do pay your taxes. That's what that means. So sometimes it is good to pay the king. It's good to pay your taxes. This is what is meant by this one, I think. And the last one, to the deities, that is the really the strange one here. And this is the one which I must admit I'm not entirely sure how Buddhist this is, whether this is a kind of a sneaking in of ideas, non-Buddhist ideas, into the Buddhist texts. Because sometimes, you know, ideas often kind of cross boundaries a little bit. And of course, this idea of giving to the gods and giving to deities is very much part of other religions like Hinduism and Brahmanical teachings and other things. If you go to many Southeast Asian countries that are really Buddhist, like Thailand, they will often have a shrine in the garden where they give to deities and they give to gods and they give to the departed and these kind of things. It's very common in South Asia and also Southeast Asia. Does anyone do this here here as well? They do it. Okay, great. Yeah. So that is kind of nice, right? If you do it in the right way, it may have maybe significant if you do it in the right way, especially thinking about your ancestors and this kind of thing. But really, I don't think offering to the deities, as far as I'm concerned, I could be wrong about this. It's very hard to know exactly how these things, but I cannot really see any particular reason from a Buddhist point of view why you would want to offer it to the deities. The deities are going to say, this miserable human food, I don't want the miserable human food. I've got all this food in heaven, right? What do you think? Offering me some sticky rice on a plate, right? I don't really want that. If I was a date, that's what I would think. If I was a date, I'd probably have a good heart and say, you know, okay, I'll look after you, whatever. But it also seems to contradict what we see in some of the other suttas. In one of the suttas, in the Ratapala Sutta, where Ratapala is speaking to King Kauravya, he talks about the four summaries of the Dhamma, right? That is the reason why he decided to go forth and become a monk. And one of the summaries of the Dhamma is that there is no protector. There is nobody, there is no overlord in the world. It's a very different idea from the traditional Buddha ideas around the world that either there is a supreme God who looks after you, or there are little deities like you have in Hinduism that look after you, right? But he is saying that there is no such deity that really look after you. And yet, this one here seems to be saying the opposite. You kind of make oblations to the deities, and the idea, I think, is that then the deities look after you in turn. But that is not really a Buddhist idea. A Buddhist idea is to be independent. You are responsible for your future through your actions, through the way you live, and there's no real need to invoke all these kind of deities to look after you. The deities may look after you anyway, but if that's the reason why they would do that, would be because you are a good person, because you keep the precepts, and because you live well, and because you have a pure mind. That is the kind of person the deities might be interested in looking after. But generally speaking, you are responsible for your life, and you cannot outsource that responsibility to the deities. Bribery, that's right, yeah. Okay, so let us look at the last one of these ones. Again, with wealth acquired by energetic striving, righteously gained, the noble disciple establishes an uplifting offering of alms, an offering that is heavenly, resulting in happiness, conducive to heaven, to those ascetic and Brahmins who refrain from intoxication and heedlessness, who are settled in patience and mildness, who tame themselves, calm themselves, and train themselves for Nibbana. This is the fourth case of wealth that is gone to good use, that has been properly employed and used for a worthy cause. So this is the last one, the kind of the support of people who practice in the right way, who do the right thing, is also a great way, according to the Buddha, to actually spend one's offerings. So do all of these things in the right proportions, right? And then you are on the right track. These householders are the four worthy deeds that the noble disciple undertakes with wealth acquired by energetic striving, amassed by the strength of his arms, earned by the sweat of his brow, righteous wealth righteously gained. When anyone exhausts wealth on anything apart from these four worthy deeds, that wealth is said to have gone to waste, to have been squandered, to have been used frivolously, like going to the casino or that sort of stuff, right? But when anyone exhausts wealth on these four worthy deeds, that wealth is said to have gone to good use, to have been properly used, to have been utilized for a worthy cause. So don't squander the money is the message here from the Buddha. Okay, so a couple of more suttas on generosity, just to really saturate completely with generosity. So fairly quick ones. This is from the exposition on offerings. I don't know if you were listening yesterday. The monk yesterday, Venerable Sivali, that very senior, actually not very senior, very junior actually, but he's kind of professor and whatever, and he was actually quoting from this sutta. I don't know if you probably weren't aware of that, but this is the sutta that he was quoting from when he was talking about Gotami going to the Buddha and wanting to offer something to the Buddha, and the Buddha said, give it to the Sangha instead. Of course, Gotami was Mahapajapati Gotami, was the Buddha's mother. He didn't actually say that yesterday. But that's what the sutta, or that quote, was from. And this is from the same sutta, but it's a different place in that sutta. And this is what it says here. There are seven kinds of offerings made to the Sangha, Ananda. One gives a gift to a Sangha of both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, headed by the Buddha. This is the first kind of offering made to the Sangha. One gives a gift to the Sangha of both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis after the Tathagata has attained final Nibbana. This is the second kind of offering made to the Sangha. Right? And this is interesting because it shows you that according to Buddhism, the highest kind of generosity offering is the kind which is given to both Sanghas, both the bhikkhus and the bhikkhunis, both the monks and the nuns. Right? So it is this kind of double, you have this kind of double possibility there when all the entire Sangha is included. It's 142. You're probably right, actually. 141 is the Satsavibhanga Sutta. That's right, yeah, 142. Sorry, thank you. Well, I'm really glad the students are really sharp here. No messing around. I check it straight away. You obviously don't trust me very much, right? You check it. No. Okay, great. Now, that's very good of you. I'm very glad you're doing that, actually, because everybody makes mistakes. That's a good thing. And the very last sutta on generosity, called A Blaze from the Sanghita Nikaya, and it goes as follows. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Savati in Jeta's Grove and at the Pindika's Park. Then, when the night had advanced, a certain devata of stunning beauty, illuminating the entire Jeta's Grove, approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he paid homage, or maybe she paid homage to the Blessed One, stood to one side, and recited these verses in the presence of the Blessed One. When one's house is ablaze, the vessel taken out is the one that is useful, not the one left burnt inside. So when the world is ablaze with the fires of aging or old age and death, one should take out one's wealth by giving. What is given is well salvaged. What is given yields pleasant fruit, but not so what is not given. Thieves take it away, or kings. It gets burnt by fire or is lost. Then in the end one leaves the body along with one's possessions. having understood this, the wise person should enjoy himself, but also give. Having given and enjoyed as fits his means, blameless, he goes to the heavenly state. This idea of the vessel taken out of the house is the one that is useful, not what is burnt inside. In the same way, you give what is given, that has been well spent. But if you have a lot of wealth, but it kind of gone to waste, not been used properly, that is like the vessel burnt inside the house. You had an opportunity to use it for something useful, but you didn't take the opportunity. That is kind of the idea behind this. So, there you are. So now, that is a lot about generosity, many of these things. There is a lot about generosity in the suttas, but those are some of the things that kind of I have come across and taken out over the years. So there you are about that. So now, we can go back to Majjhima 27 again, going back and forth. So if you'd like to go back to page 14, and we can continue there. We are still dealing with right action. We will now have a quick look at the last aspect of right action. And this says here, abandoning in celibacy. He observes celibacy, living apart, abstaining from the vulgar practice of sexual intercourse. So, this... Now we are dealing with the monastic path, and that's why it says at the beginning you go forth into monastic life, right? But of course, it is still relevant to people because there is always limitations on all of these kind of things, regardless of what kind of life you live. But first of all, I like to correct some of the translations here because translation is not very good. And it's not really abandoning in celibacy. What it is abandoning sexual activity would be much more correct to say, because celibacy just is much more limited than that. You observe not having any sexual activity. You live apart. You live by yourself or whatever. Abstaining from the common practice of sexual intercourse. The word vulgar has a very kind of pejorative meaning. It just means the common, in other words, the ordinary practice that is kind of found commonly in the world is what it really refers to. And it's interesting, isn't it, that the Buddhist path is this kind of path where you abandon all sexual activity. Why is that? And sometimes people ask this question when you look at the monastic rules. There are very strict monastic rules about being with the opposite gender and that kind of thing, right? You can't be alone with the opposite gender and this sort of thing, because once that happens, dangerous things tend to evolve from that kind of situation. So very strict rules about opposite gender and all things sexual from the monastic point of view. Why is that the case? And the reason is simply that when you are trying to practice a path of meditation, meditation and sensuality go in exactly opposite directions. The sensual world is all about going outside of yourself, enjoying the objects outside, seeing beautiful sight, listening to beautiful sound, touching nice things in the world, and it's outside of us. These are things that come from the outside. Meditation is the exact opposite. It is the happiness that comes from inside of ourselves. If you find a lot of happiness in external objects, it means that you are attached to the external world, right? You're attached to all those things in the external world that give you happiness. That is the nature of finding happiness in a certain place. You tend to get attached to that. If you are attached to external things and you try to become peaceful in your meditation practice, you can't, because the attachment stops you from allowing you to letting go of those external things, and you cannot really go inside properly. It's quite simple, right? Once you understand the dynamics here, it's easy to understand why The non-sexual life is an important part of any serious meditation practice. Serious for monastics, but also for lay people. When you go on long retreats or serious retreats, you have the similar kind of precepts for lay people as well. And that is the reason, because then it allows you to go deeper in meditation, because you are inclining to giving up the attachments to the external world. Very often you hear people say, oh, I want to have both. I want to have a nice kind of relationships and I want to have good meditation, right? And to some extent that is possible, of course. But there comes a point in life where you have to kind of make difficult choices. Actually, it's not very difficult at all, because some of the happiness is much greater than the other happiness. So actually, once you start to understand that, it's actually not that hard to make these kind of choices. So this is the reason, right? And it is, unfortunately, I think it is very rarely understood in the world that you have this kind of choice between either one or the other. Some choices need to be made in this way. People don't really understand properly what is going on there. So that is what this is about. And of course, for lay people, it is, you have more the idea of the third precept, which is about abstaining from harmful sexual conduct that is unpleasant for other people, that makes them feel oppressed or whatever. One of those things that I think is oppressive, of course, is to be unfaithful. If you are married or you are in a steady relationship, it is good to be faithful to that person. If you are not faithful to the person you are married to, it often creates enormous suffering for that person you are with. People really hate it when you kind of go off and you have affairs and things with other people outside. And yet, it is so common in our world, right? So many people have these things. It happens everywhere. Every country, wherever you go, this is kind of one of the biggest, really, really big things where people fail in morality, even Buddhists, right? Even serious committed Buddhists. I spoke to one recently, he said, oh, third precept, so difficult to keep, right? So it is really, it is, but it is important. And one of the ways of learning to keep these precepts is to remember that you're hurting people a lot by not keeping these things. That is why these things are precepts, because it is about not hurting others and to be kind to other people around you. And this is the way to learn how to do these things in the right way. Okay, so that is right action for you, samma kamanta on the Buddhist path. And there's a lot of things to think about there and to take into account. And now let us move on to right speech. There is so much in these, right? 1 hour, the amount of information, the amount of stuff that we talk about is quite large, actually. So I hope you are still able to kind of take it in. But anyway, it's all very, very nice stuff, and it's really, really worthwhile talking about all of this. And for many of you, it is going to be the last night tonight, so I'm sure that you would like to probably have as much as you possibly can, get your value for what is it? Value for, not for, so much for money, but value for time or whatever it is. So let's have a look at the last one, the samma vacha, right conduct. The third factor on the Noble Eightfold Path, samma kamanta, is the fourth one. So this is actually reversed here compared to the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. Why it is reversed, I'm not sure, but it probably means that there isn't any natural order in these things. The order is kind of haphazard. Abandoning false speech, he abstains from false speech. He speaks truth, adheres to truth, is trustworthy and reliable, one who is no deceiver of the world. Yeah, so this is about not lying, but again, you can see here, it is not just about not lying. It is actually also about being trustworthy and reliable. It is not about how can I get away with lying, but not quite lying, right? How can I kind of get away with this without kind of breaking the precept? That is the wrong way to think about this. It is about being as reliable and trustworthy as you possibly can. And that is how you kind of optimize right speech in this particular area. I know sometimes people become a bit like lawyers when it comes to the precepts. They want to know exactly the boundaries, right? So how can I kind of be within the precept but not exactly tell the truth? This is kind of the thinking sometimes people have. But that is actually missing the point, because the point is, of course, to move towards the positive aspect of speech, where you are really as reliable and trustworthy as possible. That is when you are optimizing right speech in this particular area. And also remember, as I was talking about before, all areas of morality have these shades of gray. So lying comes in a vast number of types of lying. And the really bad lying in the suttas is the kind of lying when you go to a court of law and the court says, okay, you promise to tell the truth, right? Yes, I promise to tell the truth. And then you lie regardless. That kind of stuff. And often the reason you lie is for some small thing, maybe a sense of honor, a sense of being embarrassed about what you have done, a sense of some small financial gain or something stupid like that. And then you lie because of, you know, having some kind of small gain or protecting somebody else, maybe because you are afraid of something or who knows what. Some little silly thing, and then you make a big kind of mistake of lying like that. Lying is the most serious kind of bad speech. That is why it is first here. You will note that all of these things, everything in Buddhism has a certain sequence to it. So when we just previously we had a look at the three types of bad actions, you know the sequence. What is the worst one? Exactly the same thing with speech. Lying is the worst kind of bad speech. Then comes the divisive speech, then the harsh speech, then the idle chatter is the fourth one. So remember that. So sometimes, you know, people are so afraid of lying that they sometimes kind of blurt out the truth when it is inappropriate, right? Sometimes it's better not to say anything, because sometimes you know that it is inappropriate to say something. It isn't the right occasion to speak. It's better to just shut up. And sometimes it is the case that occasionally it may even be okay to lie, depending on the situation. Again, because it is a breach of the precept, you have to be very careful in those situations. But there may be situations where lying, where the situation is so difficult, it's so hard to get out of it, and you know that telling the truth would be cruel, right? It would be outrightly wrong. It might lead to somebody dying in certain situations. And in those kind of situations, if you are skillful about it, it might be better not to tell the truth right out. Even lying in certain situations might be possible. And one situation that Ajahn Brahm always tells about, a situation, there was a man who was in hospital. He was going to have a bypass operation, and bypass operations are always, there's always a little bit of chance it will go wrong, 2 or 3%, very small chance, but there's always a little bit of chance, possibility that you might die of the bypass operation. And then he was in this room with another man, and he was also going to have a bypass operation. And one day this other man is wheeled into the operation theater, right? And then he doesn't come back. And then this man in the bed, his wife comes to visit, and he asks his wife, what happened to my friend? He went into the operation. I haven't seen him since. Is he okay? And his wife happens to know that he did not make it through that operation. He actually passed away. There was one of those rare occasions when the operation failed. But she realized that if I tell my husband the truth about this, chances are he will be so anxious and worried about the operation that the chances of failure will increase. Right? If you are worried about something, if you're anxious about something, the chances of lack of success are much greater. So she decides that this is not the right time for the truth. She was a Buddhist. She wanted to tell the truth, but she felt now is not the right time to tell the truth. So she said to him, no worries, he is okay, or something to that effect. She basically lied, right? And then, of course, the next day, her husband goes into the operation theater, gets the operation, successful operation, and later on, she can, of course, tell him the truth and the reality of what happened. But this is such a situation, right, where you're not telling falsehood for any great financial or personal gain. It is mostly out of compassion. Maybe there's obviously a little bit of self-interest there because you are the wife. So there's a little bit of self-interest, but it's also out of compassion. Even if it was a complete stranger in that bed, you probably wouldn't tell him the truth or her the truth because you would know that it would reduce the chances of success. So that is the kind of situation I have in mind, right? So again, it is the motivation, the driving force inside of you that decides the karma, not the act as such. Okay, next one. So, abandoning malicious speech, he abstains from malicious speech. He does not repeat elsewhere what he has heard here in order to divide those people from these. Nor does he repeat to these people what he has heard elsewhere in order to divide these people from those. Thus he is one who reunites those who are divided, a promoter of friendship, one who enjoys concord or harmony. Harmony is another way of translating this word. Rejoices in harmony and concord, delights in harmony and concord, a speaker of words that promote concord and harmony. This is the second most important right kind of speech. The idea of promoting harmony among people, trying to bring people together, trying to make people understand each other so we can have a bit more peaceful world. There is enough problems in this world as there is already. And of course, the way to do that is not to speak badly of others. If you speak badly of others, you are automatically creating divisions between those people and the people you are talking to. Because then they will hear the bad things and then they will immediately create a little bit of split. So much better to try to understand, speak in an understanding way. If somebody complains about somebody else, try to see why there is a problem there. Try to understand what is going on. And when you are understanding rather than judgmental of others, then you are far better placed to create harmony among people than when you are judgmental and you say bad things about others. Interesting that this is a second factor of right speech. Not harsh speech, but actually divisive speech is the problem here. So keep that in mind. It's very beautiful the way it kind of emphasizes here the idea of concord and harmony, right? Always kind of trying to promote concord and harmony here. Okay, I'm going to go through the last two ones as well, just to get to the end of right speech. I'll go through this fairly quickly. I'm sure you've heard these things before, but it's always nice to repeat, because actually I find it very, very beautiful, these very simple teachings on right speech. Abandoning harsh speech, he abstains from harsh speech. He speaks such words as are gentle, pleasing to the ear, and lovable, as go to the heart, are courteous, desired by the many, and agreeable to the many. Gentle words, right, that are pleasing, that go to the heart. Elsewhere, harsh speech is said to be speech that destroys samadhi, presumably because it has a very kind of effect on the mind, which kind of disturbs the mind a lot. So it is the opposite speech, and is a speech that leads more to samadhi and meditation practice. Gentle words going to the heart, desired by the many people. And the last one, abandoning idle speech. I think gossip is not quite right. Idle chatter. He abstains from idle chatter. He speaks at the right time. Speaks what is fact. Speaks on what is good. Speaks on the Dhamma and the training, the teaching and the training at the right time. He speaks such words that are worth recording, reasonable, moderate, and beneficial. Worth recording, the Pali word is literally to be treasured. Words to be treasured, right? Words that you put aside at the back of your mind to take out on a day when you need them, when you need to be reminded of some Dhamma treasure in your life. You bring it out again to remind you of the right way of practice, the right thing of what to do. So this beautiful idea of speaking things that are useful in life, that actually lead to real happiness, rather than all the other kind of stuff. So, that is a lot about morality, and we could go into more detail about right speech and these kind of things, but I think that is probably enough, because I think you all know about these things already, and sometimes people get a bit overwhelmed, so many details about just being moral, just by living well. How am I going to remember all of this, right? How is this possible? I can't remember all of these things. I am doomed for a bad rebirth because I can't remember all of this. And the answer is, of course, you're not doomed for a bad rebirth. Or there's only one thing you really have to remember all of this. Only one single thing, and that is kindness, right? One single word summarizes all of the things that we have been looking at. If you can be kind, if you can be gentle, compassionate and understanding at all times, in your speech, in your actions, even in the way you think, you will be fulfilling all of these things by default, automatically. And that is really all you have to remember. So keep it simple. All of these things are great to have there at the back of your mind, to remind you of the big picture, to remind you a little bit of the details. But in daily life, there's only one thing you have to remember, and that is kindness itself. And if you remember that, then you are on the highway to all good things in the world. All happiness, all the positive things for you, you're heading in that direction. And what a wonderful thing that is when that happens. So, let us have another break, and we'll see you back again at 4:45, and then we'll do some more meditation together then.